RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
And it is Super Bowl Sunday this weekend, so the football season, last football game of the year, is gone. It seems like just yesterday we were getting started on the football season, but all the games are done as of this Sunday, so we've got a Super Bowl special show today where we're going to break down all the latest as we head into Super Bowl Sunday and talk a little bit about the two coaches involved and Bill Belichick and Sean McVay. Bill, who I know very well, having worked for him and done a lot of work with him, and young Sean McVay and his background. So we're going to get into that. Remind you about LandryFootball.com. If you've not yet checked it out, folks, please do so. We've got our postseason special that you want to take advantage of. There's so much information going on this time of year with regard to recruiting. We've got an update in recruiting we're going to have for you this weekend here as we head into the final signing day on Wednesday. We'll update all the transfer news in our notebooks, as well as you know, any more coaching assistant news that will come out. There's sure to be more. In the NFL, of course, as we put the Super Bowl to bed, put the season to bed, then we turn into free agency time. So where we've got the start of the league year and all of that, what that involves, and the breakdowns of the players, the rankings of the players from this season, got all that coming for you. The draft, of course, all the latest news and notes along those lines as well. So it's one-stop shopping football all year long. Check out our postseason savings special. You don't want to miss it. And certainly we've got our podcast here every Tuesday and Thursday, the Landry Football Podcast. On Wednesday, we have the Rush the Field Podcast, a college football-only podcast. Now, we talk college football, we talk NFL here, but the Rush the Field, it's a college football podcast. You want to continue to join in that. We'll keep you up to date. Yes, college football. Don't have the college football scene covered by many outlets all year long. We'll do that on Rush the Field and take a little bit of a different tone in that we will talk also about the state of the program for some of these, in the history of the programs of a different program each week, as well as keeping you up to date on what's going on around the world of college football. Okay. The Super Bowl Sunday has developed into, over the years, a sort of a holiday, so to speak. It's a I've been fortunate to be a part of a few of them on the winning side, and then unfortunately on the losing side. And I know the difficulty of the day, but also what goes on during the process of the week. It is a very unique situation to deal with from a Super Bowl standpoint, and that is different than any other game. It is a neutral site game, which you see rarely, you know, but you see those, whether it's an overseas game in London or Mexico City or what have you. You know, most games in the league are obviously are a home field in a road game situation. This is a very unique one. It has become very corporate. I go back to the early days of the Super Bowl, where the game was not nearly as big. The calendar was much different. The Super Bowl was wrapped up by middle of January, so the Super Bowl was put to bed a couple of weeks ago by now, going back into the early stages of the Super Bowl. And now it's gotten to where it's a huge, huge corporate event. It is a big Super Bowl week, if you will, with a lot of fanfare, a lot of celebratory, a lot of corporate celebrations of the week, and it is a very, very expensive ticket. I think the first Super Bowl ticket went for $12. You could get some for $6.50. A dollar was worth a lot more back then than it is now, but you're dealing with tickets that are face value that are four digits. So obviously, things have changed a great deal. The the changes surrounding the popularity of the sport, I think it's traced back to the early stages of like 1958 and the NFL championship game between the Colts and the Giants. But then obviously when the AFL-NFL merger took place, it created an interesting dynamic and an influx of players, a very underrated American Football League that developed the Super Bowl into something that was very unique, won by the Packers in the first two, where the NFL was showing their dominance. And then obviously we know Super Bowl III, the Joe Namath Jets winning, probably the most famous Super Bowl, the most famous of the early Super Bowl, certainly, and that it was a huge upset at the time. As you go back and look at Super Bowl III and IV, the Jets and the Chiefs winning, that because the Chiefs beating the Vikings in Super Bowl IV was kind of a stamp that, hey, the year before wasn't just a fluke. This AFL thing was a reality. We didn't really see the Super Bowl be named as Super Bowl III, really. But there was a lot of talent in the AFL, and that led to the merger and the burgeoning of the league to 26 teams, and then, you know, really to 24, then to 26, then to 28, and then ultimately now to the 32. And the game itself has gone from being one of which is a championship-type game to really more of a signature event in the calendar. That is something that is really special and kind of, as I mentioned, almost like a holiday in and of itself, Super Bowl Sunday. It's years ago was moved to a primetime event or kind of a entering primetime event type of game where Super Bowl parties and all are the norm. So it is certainly an honor to play in it, knowing that so many people are watching, that the whole football world is watching. It is a little bit nerve-wracking. And I always say this every time during the Super Bowl, that the team that can make this as normal as possible has the big advantage, because your preparation, A, largely has to be done at your home city, your game planning. You need to put that in, and you need to have the first stages of the week after the conference championship games to get the whole logistics. How many tickets you're going to need each player, how many hotel rooms, so on and so forth. And then you let somebody either in the organization or within your family that's going to handle the request so that the players can focus on the task at hand, that's the football. Because you want to get, as a coaching staff, you want to get things put in place. You have a little bit of work practice-wise before you get to the city. Then you get to the Super Bowl site, as it's taken place this past weekend, this past Sunday. You have the early stages of the week, which is the media day, a little time to kind of get settled in and enjoy the trappings of the Super Bowl, and then get right into the practice week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday walkthrough, Saturday walkthrough, and then you're off and running. It is a game in which is unlike any other in terms of the execution of it during the course of the game. The pregame is much longer than any other pregame you're ever going to be a part of. The NFL is very much kind of cookie cutter in terms of how the pregame looks, how the halftime looks. Super Bowl is very different from any other game. Your players get ready, you get warmed up, you're stretched, and what you have to do is you essentially have to do it twice. So you have to get your guys paced and warmed up and ready, but then get them the time needed to take care of the fact that you're going to get a little bit cold, so you have to almost warm up twice before. So emotionally and mentally, you've got to be prepared for that. Halftime, you've got to be prepared, as in pregame, for a long waiting period. You have to redress and, you know, get into a drier clothes, because you start to settle in into the coolness of the indoors. You can adjust your temperature in the locker room to help that, but you have a lot more time to be able to make adjustments as a coaching staff, but the players have more time to kind of clean up, You have more affordability of time to give them a little bit more food, meaning orange quarters and things of that nature that that can hydrate them properly for the long layoff. And then, obviously, you have the adjustment time that you spend with your players before going out. It is a game that is the toughest one, I think, to lose because it's the closest you can get to winning a championship and then not being able to finish the deal. That is always very difficult to deal with. I remember the Super Bowl loss more than I do, you know, winning it. So that's just, at least from my perspective, how it tends to play out. The participants in this game will remember it forever. If you're fortunate enough to be into multiple ones, you're one of the few. There are some of the best players and coaches, scouts that I've ever been around that have been in the game for years and years and years and years and have done a great job. As I said, one of some of the best have never made it to the Super Bowl. It is a privilege to be there. You have to earn your way there, but you also have to have some good fortune. So when you look at the youth of a Sean McVay getting to a Super Bowl, and as well as the longevity and consistency of a Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, at all getting there multiple times now, nine, it is beyond description to recognize even getting there once. To be there nine times, just imagine what it takes. A little bit into Sean McVay, I think people know, just turned 33, very bright guy, grandfather, John McVay, coach in the league, probably more noted for being an executive with the 49ers, Bill Walsh, helping Bill Walsh build those great 49er teams. People may not know that John McVay was the coach of the New York Giants back when the famous Meadowlands fumble, Miracle in the Meadowlands, ultimately led to him being fired, but had a really good career, really good mind. His grandson is a very bright young guy, got into coaching early, was a young player. John's son, Sean's dad, they had Sean and grew up in the Atlanta area, so Sean gets to go back home. Sean is one of those whippersnappers that, you know, got into the league as a young quality control guy, and you can see how bright he was, took on many different tasks. And in many ways, even though the personalities are different, you know, I see a little Sean McVay and Bill Belichick in terms of the ingenuity, how bright he is, tremendous recall, could have done anything in or out of football and been successful. But when I watch the game or I think about the game coming up, I think, man, look, you know, not that Bill's ready to hang it up, but you're talking about a guy that his Bill Belichick that's been in the league and coached in the NFL, was coaching in the NFL when Sean McVay, before Sean McVay was McVay was born. But you do see a little bit of the old guard, new guard, but yet there's some similarities. McVay's a guy that's very creative. He has a keen understanding of the game, but more importantly, he's very humble, very adaptable, a guy that has an attitude of wanting to bring in different ideas and concepts and to delegate very well, relates very well to players. They've done a great job with personnel in Los Angeles. He's been the major part of it. He's very good with regards to that. Les Snead, the general manager, is more of a organizer. He's not the heavy lifter in terms of evaluating personnel. He's not that good at it. Sean is, and it's made a huge difference. I think people know by now that Sean came in and took over a Rams team that Jeff Fisher was having a hard time getting over 500 and has taken it to the next step. Playoffs last year, Super Bowl this year. Set the bar very high. Sean has definitely done a better job of taking the roster that was there and coaching it a lot better, but he's also done a really good job of building that roster, you know, and it's a big part of it. Sean's willing, more than willing to give credit to other people, but make no mistake that if you want to know what has been done, how it's been done. It's been done because of Sean McVay's personnel acumen in addition to his coaching acumen. Bill Belichick, what can you say about Bill? Bill grew up in a football family. Dad, Steve Belichick, was a coach. They were from the Western Pennsylvania and moved, did Steve, outside of the Cleveland area. Steve met his wife, Janine, just outside of Cleveland, played and went to Case Western Reserve right outside of Cleveland area, coached at Hiram College where he met his wife. When Steve kind of moved on and had different stops in coaching, he ended up, one of his stops was in Vanderbilt as an assistant coach for Bill Edwards. And that's where Bill Belichick was born. Shortly after losing their jobs and went to North Carolina for a little bit before settling in to Andover, Annapolis, Maryland, where Bill grew up. And Steve got a job at the Naval Academy. And after having a number of jobs and realizing that the coaching life was not going to be stable for his young family of one, Bill is an only child, Steve Belichick got a job at the Navy where he was not only assistant coach, but he was a professor. He earned tenure, and he was one of the best scouts around. He authored one of the great books on scouting, and he learned the game from a lot of really good coaches, but spent a lot of time at the Naval Academy in the very successful era where Navy football was a power. So he was a big part of it. And Bill learned and grew up in that environment and learned as a coach and grew. Bill got his first job in football, making $25 a week for Ted Marchibroda and the Baltimore Colts, 1975. And then his dad, Steve, one of his best friends, was Rick Forzano, who worked together at the Naval Academy with Steve Belichick and was Bill's godfather, gets a job in Detroit and hires Bill Belichick, giving him his first job as an on-field coach, as tight end coach, and working with the special teams. And that's where it all started. Bill was always a bright guy. He was an economics major at Wesleyan College, just a brilliant thinker. He could have done anything. And saw the game a little differently. Bill was a type that could take ideas and was smart enough to think outside the box, much like Sean McVay. And that's the difference. You know, people ask me all the time, and of course Bill goes on to Detroit and then gets a job in Detroit, does a good job, has an opportunity to go as Rick Forzano was let go in Detroit, went on to Denver. Things didn't work out very well there, and Belichick tried to get a job at the Air Force with the head coach at Air Force at the time, Bill Parcells. Bill Parcells was, at the time, looking to make a move out of the Air Force as they were looking to move on from him, and Parcells was speaking with the head coach of the Giants at the time, Ray Perkins, about taking a job on his staff. So Parcells goes to the Giants, and lo and behold, Bill Belichick also gets an opportunity in an interview with the Giants and gets special teams coach job and work with the linebackers under defensive coordinator Bill Parcells. And as normally happens when you get a job with a team, normally the family stays behind, what have you, and you're living out of a hotel for a while till you find your home. Well, Parcells and Belichick stayed at the same hotel, and for about, I think a few months anyway, was at the hotel and ate a lot of meals together and spent a lot of time, and actually working together on that side of the ball, developed a good working relationship. And, of course, I think at this point you know the story of Ray Perkins getting hired to replace Bear Bryant at Alabama. He leaves the head coaching job with the Giants, go to Bama, and they promote Bill Parcells to head coach with the Giants at that point. And Bill Belichick kind of rises up under Parcells. And I think, the story from there. Bill ends up going to Cleveland as the head coach. It's where I met Bill, got hired by Bill with the Browns. Contrary to popular belief, people think that Bill was not successful in Cleveland. And, you know, it's funny how a false narrative gets put out there, and people don't realize that they don't take the time to study and realize that nothing could have been further from the truth. Bill inherited a really, really bad team from Bud Carson, an old roster that had to be rebuilt. It was rebuilt, and it was built with a solid foundation, and it got better and better. Bill ended up building a team that was really good. People forget. They go from really bad to he built them into a playoff team. They went to the playoffs and beat in the playoffs a Bill Parcells-coached New England Patriots team. The team is so good that the next year, and this, remember, was before free agency hit, where teams that normally started to build, you could see a team getting better. And they started to, you start to take a step and take a step, and then maybe take a next run on the ladder, and then you were the team the next year. Well, that team for the next year, the Cleveland Browns, picked by many as the Super Bowl favorites. Really good team. People forget that. Belichick built them into that. They say he was a failure. Oh, it was tough in the early going because he had to get rid of some players that had some, you know, name value but weren't really pulling their own weight. He had to go in a different direction, and he did so. But he built them into a team that was a Super Bowl caliber team. That very year that they were picked as one of the favorites for the Super Bowl, start out okay, but pretty early in that season, there's the news that Art Modell's moving the team to Baltimore, and everything collapsed. Art picked up, moved his family to Baltimore. There was no leadership, no guidance. People in the organization, some of them were leaving, going here or there, and the whole season collapsed. And unfortunately, they decided to part ways with Bill Belichick. I think a mistake in Art Modell's, but Art Modell was able to still win a Super Bowl in his own right. But what happened, I often think about for Cleveland fans, had they not had that move, had they been able to secure a deal. And that's not just on Art Modell. That's on the civic leaders, Bill White, the mayor, and in Cleveland. Had they been able to secure a stadium and get things done like they should have done, a team probably never moves. That team, I don't know if that team would have gone to the Super Bowl or not, but it would have been really good. And there's no doubt in my mind, with patience, which Art Modell did not have, that the Baltimore Ravens, or excuse me, what became the Baltimore Ravens success or the New England Patriots success, all of that was basically could have been in Cleveland. So they would have never gone to Baltimore, and Bill Belichick likely would have put together a lot of what he's done in New England in Cleveland. And who knows, the Browns' history of, you know, losing the franchise and getting one back and the troubles there, who knows what would have happened. But all the problems there started, quite frankly, when Art moved the team and then kind of pulled the rug out from it. But there is a misconception that Bill was not successful. Bill then goes to work for Parcells with the Jets, in New England. Then with the Jets, when Bill leaves and goes to the Jets, and then obviously we know the whole story of Belichick spurning the Jets and going back to New England, and as they say, the rest is history. What does make Bill Belichick tick? I tell people all the time, Bill knows what he wants in players. He wants smart players. He wants tough players. He wants dedicated players. He wants coaches that are smart, scouts that are smart, that will work, that can learn. He doesn't care what you know. He cares about your ability to learn because he knows what he wants you, what he wants to teach you, and he can train you on how to see the game the way he sees it. He can give you the blueprint. If you don't have the aptitude or the work ethic that he does, you won't be as good, but you will certainly be open to the door of the professor that knows the game as well as anybody, certainly that I've been around. And I think he is definitely not only in the group, but maybe sitting eventually on the top of the group of the greats of all time, the Vince Lombardis, the Paul Browns. Now, You know, this is not picking favorites here. Lombardi had really good ideas, as did Tom Landry off the Giants staff, as Tom Landry went to Dallas and Lombardi to Green Bay. But the most innovative coach in modern football history is Paul Brown. He did things, he was ahead of his time, and he was even more innovative than Vince Lombardi, for example. But Paul Brown's time ended coaching-wise before the Super Bowl era. His championships were AAFL championships and NFL championships. That was his legacy. He was the most innovative coach. I think Bill Belichick has maybe equaled. I don't know if it's fair to say he surpassed or equaled. I just know that I think that the two most brilliant minds in football history are Paul Brown and Bill Belichick. Paul Brown was not only a builder as a coach, but he's a general manager, and that's what Bill Belichick is for the Patriots and always has been. Those of us that have had ties to him were changed forever. I get, you know, it's funny because when I hear people say, talking heads talk about, you know, well, I broke this tape down and, you know, even ex-players and all that, I always laugh because you may have watched the game, but you don't see the game the way a football genius like Bill Belichick sees it. And there's such a huge difference. And I am so blessed and honored to have been able to learn from him, because seeing the game the way he taught me is unlike anything that most people just don't get that opportunity. And it's nothing that I really earned. It was fortunate. I was fortunate to be interviewed by him for a low-level job and earn my way and learn the hard way, the right way. And, you know, watching, you can watch games all you want. If you're not trained on how to watch games and you don't see the game, you haven't truly watched the game. You don't truly understand the whys. What happened is easy. That's what you hear people on TV talk about. Why it happened is what true football geniuses are all about, and being able to see it. So it ought to be a great matchup. Let's get into the game, as I got a little bit off into the coaches. But a couple of things that jump out at me. Going and looking at, and we're going to have a complete, obviously, breakdown of the game on LandryFootball.com. But I look at a couple of things with the Rams during the course of the year. Breaking down the tapes, going back and looking at games during the course of the year. The games in particular that I focused a lot on is, you know, I looked at a lot of the positives of what they did, but you always tend to look at the games as well that they didn't play very well and why. You know, week 5 against Seattle, week 8 against Green Bay, week 14 against the Bears, week 15 against the Eagles. The Eagles, I'm going to remind you, beat the Rams. The Bears beat the Rams. The Packers did not beat them. The Seahawks didn't beat them in week 5. But they showed, opened up some flaws into the system, so to speak. And the one thing that just jumped out at me when watching the Rams is defensively, the run defense got killed in those games. In those four games that I mentioned, they gave up a total of 601 yards on 116 carries, over 5 yards average. They really graded poorly in those games. At their worst, they were among the worst run defenses in the league. They finished 28th. Full season run defense, so overall they weren't very good. This could be a significant problem if that continues against this run heavy Patriots team. New England ranked in the top 5 in runs, yards and touchdowns on the ground, and they only ranked 9th in overall run offense grade this year. The Patriots had only 3 games this year in which they failed to run at least 20 times. Okay. So keep that in mind. If the Patriots can't run the football at least 20 times, they're not going to win. They lost in the 3 games this year that they failed to run 3 times. They lost all those games to the Lions, to the Titans, to the Steelers. Pittsburgh game was a tight, low-scoring game, and they abandoned the run a little bit. Brady threw 36 passes against a run defense that just was playing really well and wasn't as good against the pass, so it was a little bit game plan directive. But Detroit and Tennessee handcuffed New England's running game with their offense. and you hear me often talk about complementary football. It's how you play offense, it's how you play defense. So those teams, Detroit and Tennessee, got a lead, scored a combined 37 first half points, while the Patriots managed only 13. That forced Brady to put the ball in the air, play catch up. That's not what the Patriots do. I think people kind of have the impression, oh, put it in Brady's hand, is to throw it across the yard, and that's the way it'll work. That's not how they're built. If the Rams can get a similar lead in the Super Bowl, that's the formula. The Rams defense had another major problem in those four games. And let me just say this. The Rams defense, run defense, is a lot better in the playoffs. They defended the Cowboys run well. And they defended the Saints run well. That's going to be key. And the first thing that jumps out at me when you look at this game is, yeah, turnovers are going to be important. The Patriots are a plus 10 in turnover margin, and these losses that the Rams took, they're a minus 4. They tend to turn it over a little more. That's going to be pivotal. But it really, you know, the first thing that jumps out at me is the run defense of the Rams. How good or how bad is it going to be against this Patriots run game? Simple as that. It's going to be important. The Rams defense also, in these losses, got killed by big-time receivers. Alshon Jeffery, Tyler Lockett, Devontae Adams, combined for 16 catches, almost 400 yards. Four touchdowns in only 19 targets. That's a catch rate of 84% and an average of 20.6 yards per throw. That includes a perfect performance rate on deep balls, 8 for 8 for 302 yards, with an average of 37.8 per throw. Now, the Bears didn't have a receiver with a positive grade against the Rams, but sub-freezing temperature, windy City, Chicago game contributed to that. Now, let me just say this. Aqib Talib missed the Seahawks and Packers game, but he did play against the Eagles. We also saw the Rams do a good job in the playoff game against Michael Thomas. Now, the Patriots don't have much of a vertical passing game, so this is an area where they may not be able to exploit as much. But if they're able to get the running game going, they might try to attack a little bit more vertically, because the run game will slow down the pass rush, which will allow them to get more into 5 and 7 step drops to where they can get a little bit more vertical. The Patriots don't have the vertical receiver. Josh Gordon was one, but he's been long gone, won't be playing. And then Gronk has some vertical element to his game, but he hasn't been as effective and with his health and with how they've worked the horizontal passing game. His numbers have been down on those type passes this year. His catch rate is just under 33%, which the league average for tight ends on vertical routes is closer to 42%. Chris Hogan and Julian Edelman have good deep ball catch rates at 53 and 57%, but they only combined have 33 targets, so they don't get it vertical much. The Rams were actually pretty good defending tight ends this year, even in their worst games, including guys like Jimmy Graham and Trey Burton and Zach Ertz. They did a good job. They held opposing tight ends to one catch for 21 yards and 7 targets. Gronk will need to do better, and probably will. In his play, will certainly open up things for Hogan and Edelman. For the Rams, offense been pretty good. Even in bad games, even in their losses, the Rams' offense has been consistent. It's been good. Now, Goff threw 4 interceptions against the Bears. He had 2 against the Seahawks and another against the Eagles. Meanwhile, the defense only collected 4 interceptions, 2 of them in 1 game against Chicago. That's a big reason why the Rams were negative 4 in turnover margin in those worst games, and it could have been much worse. The Rams fumbled 6 times in those games, while the opponent fumbled just once, but the Rams recovered 5 of those 7 loose balls. So make mistakes, the Patriots will kill you, because they normally don't make the mistakes. As I mentioned, they were plus 10 in turnover margin, which is 5th best in the league. They had a negative turnover margin 3 times this year, did the Patriots. One of one was against Kansas City last week, which they got away from. Kansas City, as we know, they line up offsides, onsides. They're in the Super Bowl, and we're talking about them. But I don't know that this Patriots passing game is an ideal fit to attack this Rams defense, but their versatile run game and horizontal passing game, along with turnover margin, could be the key here. The Rams are going to have to get off to an early lead, I think. We're going to get into why as we break down the Patriots. I think they're also going to have to defend the run well. They protect the football, defend the run well, get that early lead, the Rams will win the game. That's the formula for them. But the Patriots, you know, breaking down all their games this year, the games in which they're most vulnerable, week two against Jacksonville, week three against Detroit, then week 10 against Tennessee, and week 14 against Miami. In three of these games, New England was effectively knocked out early. Even in the Dolphins' loss, they trailed at the end of the first quarter, although it was just by a single point. But if you look at it, the Patriots were a perfect 11-0 when leading at the end of the first quarter. When they were tied or trailing 15 minutes into the game, they finished 2-5. Obviously, you want to play from ahead than behind. It's obvious. But this year in the league, teams that were ahead after the first quarter went 156-50, winning more than three-quarters of their games. But New England had an even higher percentage rate, about 80% winning with a first-quarter lead. But they were not able to play catch-up this year. The Patriots were 25th in overall offensive grades this year when trailing by 8 or more points. Including sacks, Brady averaged only 5.2 yards per dropback when down by 2 scores. The running game wasn't much better, averaging 3.6. Okay, so it's only 168 plays where this took place. So it wasn't, you know, wasn't a small sample size here. However, those 168 plays were limited entirely to those losses against the Jags, the Lions, and the Titans. When the Patriots trailed by smaller deficits, tied or down by 1 to 7 points, they were third offensively in the league. Their offense was third in the league in performance, in productivity, in execution. Get a sizable lead on the Patriots, you have them where you want them. They overcame a 28-3 deficit against the Falcons. The offense this year doesn't play out that way to where I don't think that they're likely to overcome that. You know, Brady played well enough even in the bad games. I didn't think as well as he played against Kansas City, he did throw 3 picks. He was beatable last week, and the Chiefs didn't make him pay. Even in the bad games this year that we're mentioning with Brady, completed fewer than 60% of his passes and averaged less than 7 yards per pass, threw 8 touchdowns with only 1 interception in those games. On the ground, however, the Patriots were neutralized in those games. Again, Brady will protect the football for the most part, but if they can't run, they won't win. It's as simple as that in this game. Shutting the ground game down and forcing Brady the throw is the way you win against the Patriots this year. Simple as that. It's not simple to do, but it's simple to understand. As for New England's defense, there were times where they were bad in these losses. Would have been worse against the run, against the pass, and overall, during the course of the year, one of the worst in the league during these periods. They allowed 5.3 rushing yards per carry and 150 yards per game in these losses. Opposing quarterbacks in these losses completed 70% of their passes, 9.2 yards per throw, and 11 touchdowns with only 2 interceptions. And keep in mind, the guys doing it were Blake Bortles, Marcus Mariota, Ryan Tannehill. You also had Matthew Stafford in there. The Patriots were especially putrid on first down defensively, giving up 374 yards on 64 carries, almost 6 yards average, while opponents completed 37 of 51 passes for 628 yards. That's a 73% completion rate, folks. 12.3 yards per throw, 7 touchdowns, no interceptions, and only 3 sacks. Defense playing a lot better now. They're playing playoff football now. I think Sean McVay's offensive start here will be critical. I think you can attack them sharp, medium, and deep if you're on. If there was a weak area of the defense that I saw for New England, it came on throws to the offensive left, which were completed 77% of the time for 10.0 yards per play, including 7.1 yards after the catch per completion. Passes to the right or middle were completed 10% less often. 2 fewer yards per play. The Rams, as you might expect, like to attack with multiple receivers and attack all areas of the field. They had 7 different players. Now, this includes also Cooper Kupp, who's out for the year. Had 15 or more targets on throws to the offensive left for the Rams. The best of them was Brandon Cooks, who caught 73% for over 14.4 yards per catch. I say it again, I think the Rams need to take an early lead in this game. You get the Patriots down, it'll keep the New England offense one-dimensional, while at the same time letting the Rams play with the type of versatility that they need. That will in turn let the Rams have a chance to beat the Patriots with their own weapon, ball control. The Patriots only converted 18 of 52 third downs in their bad games, while their opponents went 23 for 47, converting nearly half the time. Patriots are playing better ball now. The Rams, obviously, are playing better ball. I bring out these negative things not to be negative, but one of the things we do in the breakdowns when you're preparing in the league is you see how people have had successes. You know, there people will say, oh, the team played poorly. Team X played poorly. Team Y played poorly. Well, yeah, they did, but there's something to that, too. There are reasons for it to some degree. If you look at it, what can you force the team to do to have a bad game? These are some of the things I hope I was able to bring out for you. When these teams struggled, this is why they struggled. So to recap, New England gets an early lead or stays close, they usually win. But get the Patriots down early, they struggle because they're a run-first team. And that works the short-to-intermediate passing game horizontally, get the ball out quick. It all stems from the ability to run it. So shut down the Patriots run game, get an early lead, you know, say a 10-14, and you're more than halfway home. The issue with the Rams defense is run defense in particular has not played well this year, but it is much improved in the playoffs versus Dallas, versus New Orleans. There's no doubt about that. If they can play really good run defense, this is going to allow them to be successful. There's a lot of talk. There's no question that the Rams have played more zone as the season developed during the course of the year. Brady eats up zone, but you got to tackle well. And I think you need to force the ball deep outside the numbers. If you can stop the run and force the ball outside the numbers, if you're the Rams, you're in really good shape. I think the Rams defense is vulnerable to the deep ball, but that's not, again, what the Patriots comfortably do. Turnovers are always a huge factor. Rams don't protect the ball very well. The Patriots do. It's likely pivotal in this game's outcome. I think the Rams, if they get a lead, maybe get up by double digits, they might be able to win and might be able to win, you know, comfortably. I don't see them blowing them out, but I could see that being a problem where the Patriots, it could get worse, and I don't know if this team is capable of coming back big. But I do like the fact that of the two teams, I expect the Patriots to play a cleaner game, a game in which I think that they're going to be more effective at doing the little things well. The Patriots don't beat themselves for the most part. So the Rams have to play a clean game. They can't really turn the football over and give the Patriots extra chances, or it's going to be curtains. If it's close, I like the Patriots. I like Tom Brady in a close game. I mean, that's nothing. You're not getting something out of that comment that you can't get anywhere else, of course. But that's real. But I don't think what people may understand is that it's not a given that the Patriots win, because I do think there's some vulnerabilities. But again, I think that Bill Belichick can hide those things well, has hit them well. I said it, breaking down the tape, I thought the four best teams during the year were the four best teams that played the championship game. But I got to tell you, the two best teams, in my opinion, are the Saints and the Chiefs. I think we're seeing the third and fourth best teams in the league right now off of tape by a small margin. These teams have earned the right to be here, folks. Do not misunderstand me. But I think that that's, in my opinion, an indication of how well coached these teams are and how well they've maximized certain issues. We know the situation in the NFC was in large part due to a bad call. But for Kansas City, I thought Kansas City, after early struggles, came back. And again, they can line up onside. That game's over, and the Chiefs advance to the Super Bowl. We're talking about very easily the Chiefs and the Saints in a Super Bowl game. But we're seeing two well-coached teams, two teams that maximize what they can do well. And I think the Patriots, offensively, it's about the horizontal passing game, the run game. Gronk's going to be a factor in both the blocking and receiving. Defensively, it's going to be about putting pressure on Jared Goff. I thought the Saints let Goff off the hook a little bit. The Rams off the hook a little bit. I thought they had a great opportunity to put the game away early defensively, just like the Saints had a chance to put the game away early offensively. I think Belichick's going to bring a lot of heat on Goff, and it's going to test him and force some mistakes. So, listen, I could see the game going either way. I know that's a cop-out point, but I do, and certainly in a close game, I like the Patriots. The fact that I think that the Patriots will be able to put some pressure on Goff, I think that that could be a difference, and turnovers are always a huge factor. So I do like the Patriots in a close one. I think if it's a decisive win, it's more likely that the Rams would win that type of game. And decisive, I mean by double digits, 10 points, 14 points. I think the Rams are more likely to win that type of game. But I do think a close game, I like the Patriots' chances there. Hope you enjoy it. Hope you enjoy all the aspects, your Super Bowl parties, everything that you like to do for Super Bowl week. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great time with your family, enjoying the games. Be safe if you're in the frigid cold weather that is affecting much of the country. We appreciate you joining us. We'll be, again, transitioning. We'll break down the Super Bowl game, of course. We'll be transitioning into the next phase of football and the going-ons in the offseason and the work that's done that's going to keep you up to date better than ever before on your football teams and the football world as a whole, college and NFL. So make sure you take advantage of that postseason savings special on LandryFootball.com today and sign up for the newsletter. Another one coming out in the morning, so you want to be on tap for that. Get that out to us. Hit the War Room icon on LandryFootball.com and send us your email address. Free, we'll get it to you. Appreciate you joining us. Enjoy the game, everybody. Talk to you Tuesday.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
I'm Jerry Petuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.